This is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website funtrivia.com. We have a couple of kazoo questions for you today. Question number one, in what country was the first true kazoo invented? Was that A, USA, B, Ireland, C, Germany, or D, India? Hint, the kazoo is technically a singing membranophone, meaning that the sound is simply an altered version of an outside sound and that the alteration is caused by the vibrations of a membrane. Kazoos can be made from a variety of materials such as wood, metal, plastic, and comb and tissue paper. There are many different shapes of kazoos that can be made to imitate various woodwind and brass instruments. And question number two, which decade was the commonly accepted quote-unquote golden age of kazoos? Was that A, 1880s, B, 1920s, C, 1950s, or D, 1970s? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of July the 13th. Well, it was on this day back in 1795, you may remember, that the French National Convention accepted La Marseillaise as the French national anthem. It was the first national anthem of France, 1795 on this day. And it was 25 years ago today, 1993, that the U.S. Postal Service released 29-cent stamps that honored four Broadway musicals. The featured scenes were from My Fair Lady, Porgy and Bess, Showboat, and Oklahoma, 1993. Lonnie Mack's Too Rock for Country, Too Country for Rock introduces today Country Music News. It's an article titled, A Little Pop, A Little Country, and A Big Hit. This is written by Joe Levy, published in Rolling Stone magazine, July 2018. The streaming revolution has opened up unprecedented cross-genre opportunities. The biggest country song of 2018 to date is from the Brooklyn-born, Staten Island-raised, hip-hop-loving BB REXHA, whose single Meant to Be, a duet with Florida Georgia Line, has racked up more than 1 billion streams worldwide and had spent 27 weeks at number one on Billboard's Hot Country Songs chart as of June 9th. Country has long embraced pop and hip-hop and rock, with Florida Georgia Line scoring past hits with both the Backstreet Boys and Nelly. But the cross-pollination of pop and country we're witnessing now is new and powerful. Streaming is changing the rules, says Tom Corson, co-chairman and COO of REXHA's label, Warner Brothers. Country's always been very close to pop, and pop a little less close to country, but you're getting a generation of writers and artists who listen to both. As people open up, programmers and playlisters, there's more room to move across genres. Well, I'm too rock, country, too country. Leonard Bernstein conducts Somewhere from West Side Story. To introduce our classical music news, it's a book review of Jamie Bernstein's famous Father Girl. This is published in BroadwayWorld.com by Erica Miner, June the 13th, 2018. Jamie Bernstein has described her newly minted book, Famous Father Girl, a memoir of growing up Bernstein, as a love letter to my whole family. It is a love letter filled with candid, disarmingly frank memories. An insider's view of what it was like to grow up as the eldest daughter of the most influential American musician of the 20th century. Leonard Bernstein, or LB, as Jamie came to call him in her young adult years. Bernstein clearly has inherited her father's gift for self-expression in words, as well as a goodly amount of his boldness and charisma. She is impressively articulate in her descriptions, not only of family events, but of her feelings about everything, from her parents' relationship with each other, to her relationship with her siblings, to her own adolescent angst. Her writing is fearlessly honest. She's not afraid to analyze her father's faults, to criticize him, to express her unease at his criticism of her and of her mother, Felicia. But behind each and every word lies a profound affection for the man she calls Daddy, who was so frequently absent from the family abode with his conducting tours that she and her siblings never felt we got enough of him. The love between a father and a daughter is a complex subject that has been examined under a high-power psychological microscope since the time of the ancient Greeks. In Bernstein's case, the complexities are compounded to the power of 40x by virtue of LB's stratospheric level of stardom, unprecedented for a musician who was the first American to be named music director of a major symphony orchestra, the New York Philharmonic, not to mention being the youngest ever and Jewish. Notoriety is a double-edged sword, and LB's fame was of mythical proportions. Bernstein acknowledges both positive and negative aspects of her father's renown, describes how she and her siblings created a force field, a layer of insulation from the raucous, confusing world of their parents, with its endless stream of high-status friends and colleagues converging on the Bernstein abode. Bernstein's anecdotes of that perplexing family cluster range from amusing to cringeworthy. As a four-year-old observing her parents dressed to the nines for the opening of Candide in 1956, she asks, "Where are they going?" "We're going to see Candide," her mother tells her. "They were going to see Candy," she writes, "and wants to go with them." But when her mother says it's only for grown-ups, Jamie doesn't understand. "Candy for grown-ups? Impossible. But I want to see the candy," she cries, as her parents bustle off, leaving her and her tantrum to their devoted nanny. Later in life, Bernstein recounts tales of her admittedly squirmy adolescence. She expresses her glee at its discoveries, e.g., meeting the Beatles in person, and her painful embarrassment at its discomforts, sex rearing its ugly head. But she delights in her father's efforts to remain integrated into the progressive phases of her life and to share in her discoveries. She especially takes pleasure in his fascination with rock music. "Whenever a new Beatles album appeared in the household," she writes, "we'd sit together on his couch to scrutinize the lyrics while the album played. 'Wow, can you believe that chord?' her father says. 'So fresh!'" In many ways, Bernstein perceived her father first and foremost as a teacher and reveled in his incorporating what he gleaned from his daughter into his young people's concerts, often showcasing rock musicians as guests. Young Jamie wasn't old enough to comprehend Janis Ian's song, Society's Child, but Daddy completely grasped the power of its music and lyrics. The tone of the book turns darker as the family secrets and misfortunes come to the forefront. In tandem with a world of glamour lived large, tragedy and unnerving revelations ensue for the young Bernstein. Most painful of all was her mother's illness and tragic death at the age of 56. In light of Leonard Bernstein's centenary and the many celebrations taking place to commemorate his prominence, Famous Father Girl fits squarely into the list of must-see and must-read celebratory phenomena related to this monumental occasion. Compellingly written, alternately humorous and poignant, continually entertaining, the book serves as a window into the core of a quintessentially illustrious, multifaceted man, his family, and the daughter who loves him, not always unconditionally, but with tenderness and deep-rooted affection. Nothing conveys Daddy's deepest essence better than his own music, Bernstein writes. When we listen to that music, it's the next best thing to getting a hug from Daddy himself. As an addendum to this article, we have another article, this one written by Michael Silverstein, in How to Pronounce My Name. This was published in classicalmusicindie.org on May 31, 2016. People used to have no trouble pronouncing my last name. Silverstein, with the last syllable pronounced Steen, even though it's spelled S-T-E-I-N. They also had no problem with Goldstein, Bernstein, Weinstein, and all the other Steens, which were all pronounced with the same Steen ending. The only time anyone used to address me or the other Steens with a Stein ending was when they wanted to be offensive. Such a pronunciation amounted to a backhanded ethnic slur. And then Leonard Bernstein came along. He didn't cause trouble in this realm right away. As a young man from a small town near Boston, he was known as Lenny Bernstein, with a Steen ending. If a Bernstein, such as Leonard, were now a cultural icon in this country, he seemed to feel, then such a person should somehow be more closely associated in people's minds with European cultural icons. And since Leonard was now in the classical music business, the natural linkage was with the great Polish pianist Arthur Rubinstein, and Stein is how it's pronounced. So it was that Leonard Bernstein ultimately became Leonard Bernstein. Bernstein's moniker metamorphosis also happened to coincide with an ethnic identity surge that had afflicted many Jews in recent years. They seemed to feel that pronouncing their names the way they were pronounced in European countries from which their grandparents fled in horror was a worthwhile endeavor. Go figure. I don't see this identity crowd as primarily to blame for the pronunciation hassles I must now endure, however. In my view, they have simply done collateral damage in this regard. The Steen-Stein confusion is primarily due to that Lenny guy. And in jazz music news, we have this review of Vince Guaraldi's album titled Oh Good Grief. This is published in newreleasesnow.com on the 6th of July, 2018. Many people got to know Vince Guaraldi through his 1963 Grammy-winning song, Cast Your Fate to the Wind. Lee Mendelson heard it when working on a Peanuts documentary and contacted Guaraldi, asking him to score the upcoming Peanuts Christmas special. Now for its 50th anniversary, Omnivore Recordings is proud to present the album The Way the World First Heard It. And in music research and technology, we have this article entitled, Meet the Italian Composer Who Conducts the World's Biggest All-Robot Orchestra. This is written by Luc Dormeil on the 19th of June, 2018, and published in digitaltrends.com. Thanks to the digitized instruments found on Pro Tools and GarageBand, any wannabe music producer can command a virtual orchestra in 2018 using no more hardware than a single laptop. If they're really serious about their craft, they might plug in an MIDI keyboard, a guitar, or a standalone sampler to go one step further. That's nothing compared to Italian electronic music producer Leonardo Barbadoro. For his latest album, he's still using a computer to program his instruments, but thanks to some impressive robot technology, the instruments are all real. In all, Barbadoro's music is composed using a robot orchestra that's capable of playing more than 50 acoustic instruments on command. These range from piano and organ to wind instruments and percussion. Barbadoro is able to control these real instruments from his laptop, with the real sound then recorded in a way that he can use it for his compositions. The purpose, perhaps somewhat ironically, is to achieve a more human sound than you'd get from your regularly digitally synthesized instruments, due to the playing of actual instruments in a real acoustic space. "I have been working on this project for a long time now," he told Digital Trends. "Everything started in 2011 when I was in Ghent, Belgium, to play a show, and a guy there showed me the website of the Logos Foundation. These people have built robots to play acoustic instruments for the past 20 years. It is now the largest robot orchestra in the world. I thought the whole concept was amazing, and finally decided to get in touch with them in 2014. I visited the foundation about 10 times to learn how these instruments work, and then composed and recorded Musica Automata, a 10-minute composition for 19 robots controlled by a laptop computer. Taken with the versatility of the robots, Barbadoro has expanded this into an album, while also working to build his own robots, including one designed to play an unusual Persian-stringed instrument. To complete the album, Barbadoro is now raising funds on Kickstarter. As a reward, he's offering the album in various forms, including digital download and vinyl, along with the opportunity to attend a live performance of his robot music. As ever, we offer our usual cautions about the potential issues that can befall crowdfunding campaigns. However, if you're interested in getting involved with this blurring of digital music and authentic analog sound, head over to the project's Kickstarter page for more information. The finished product is due to be delivered in early 2019. Stevie Wonder's Sir Duke introduces our rock and pop music news item. It's an article written by Will Hermes, published in Rolling Stone magazine, July 2018 issue. Stevie Wonder, ranking the Pop Soul's geniuses' albums from Motown pop to visionary punk and beyond. There are 4 must-have albums and 5 further listening albums. The 4 must-haves include Talking Book, 1972. This watershed is Wonder's Revolver, where he transcends his hit machine youth and moves to the higher ground, creatively, politically, and spiritually. You Are the Sunshine of My Life is the user-friendly opener. Superstition, the next level funk anthem. He's playing nearly every instrument himself, including drums and Moog synthesizer. But his antenna are up. Maybe Your Baby gets full-on funkadelic with Sky Kissing Guitar by a teenage Ray Parker Jr. And Looking for Another Pure Love features a blissful contribution from Jeff Beck. Big Brother, meanwhile, addresses government surveillance with a carefree musical countenance, a portrait of the artist as a young genius, woke and fully formed. Then there's Inner Visions. This was a 1973 album. The peak of his 70s apotheosis, it opens on the jazz funk of Too High, an indictment of curdled drug culture. And Don't You Worry About a Thing taps the ascendant sound of New York salsa. The defining moment is the 7-minute Livin' for the City, a ghetto tale about a family struggling in a rigged system, as chillingly resonant as ever. And then there's Looking Back, 1977 album, the definitive triple LP compilation of Wonder's early Motown hits, from rave-ups, Uptight, Everything's All Right, to ballads, My Cherie Amour, many written by the prodigy himself. And finally, Songs in the Key of Life, 1976, his most ambitious set, a double LP with a 4-song overflow EP. The hit Sir Duke, which is playing in the background now, calls out Ella, Satchmo, and Ellington amid spectacular horns, and As describes a love supreme with Herbie Hancock on Fender Rhodes. There's Memoir, I Wish, and some of Wonder's most unsparing political art, like Black Man, an epic about shout-out to global game changers, a group in which, starting here, Wonder becomes a member. Once again, this is Sir Duke from Songs in the Key of Life, his 1976 album. The 5 albums that Will Hermes recommends for further listening include Music of My Mind from 1972, Hotter Than July from 1980, Fulfillingness First Finale from 1974, Signed, Sealed, and Delivered from 1970. His first studio album of the 70s is also his first in the co-producer's chair. The difference is mainly in the magnificent vocals, which are off the leash in a new way. The instrumental palette, too, is growing, along with Wonder's taste for hard funk. You can't judge a book by its cover. The hits, foremost the title track, Signed, Sealed, and Delivered, shine bright, and his euphoric reading of We Can Work It Out ranks with the greatest Beatles covers ever recorded. And finally, Stevie Wonder's Journey Through the Secret Life of Plants from 1979, a double LP of vine-like instrumentals with a few eccentric vocal cuts thrown in. Conceived as the soundtrack to the documentary The Secret Life of Plants, a time-lapse exploration of plant biology, it's a sonic roulette wheel. Wonder uses the first sampling synthesizer, the Melodeon, to weave bird and insect sounds and other verite material through Indian and Asian motifs, classical gestures, and jazz vamps. As Wonder's weirdest record, it's a marvelous trip.
She had a guitar and she taught him some chords. The sky was the limit.
And in local music news, we have an upcoming concert Saturday, July 14th at 7:30 p.m. at the Booth Amphitheater, Cary. It's part of NC Symphony's Summerfest 2018. This one's called The Music of Tom Petty. Phone 919-733-2750 or go to their website, ncsymphony.org, for more information and tickets. Celebrate the life and music of rock icon Tom Petty, with a singer and a full rock band joining the symphony to perform favorites like Learning to Fly, Free Falling, American Girl, and You Wreck Me. And this has been Tom Petty performing Into the Great Wide Open in the background right now.
They made a record and it went in the charts. The sky was the limit.
So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, in what country was the first true kazoo invented? Was that A, the USA, B, Switzerland, C, Germany, or D, India? Correct answer. Answer A, USA. Yes, the kazoo is as American as apple pie. Invented by a man named Alabama Vest in Macon, Georgia. He came up with the idea in the 1840s and teamed up with the German master clockmaker Thaddeus von Klegg to make it. However, metal kazoos weren't made until a traveling salesman named Emil Sorg teamed up with Michael McIntyre, a tool and die maker, to set up a factory in Western New York in 1912. McIntyre later teamed up with Harry Richardson, a business owner, to produce the All-American Kazoo. McIntyre patented the kazoo in 1923. Kazubi, which sells 500,000 kazoos annually, moved to Port Richie from Hilton Head, starting a whole new kazoo subculture there. The Kazoo Factory Museum and Gift Shop of Eden, New York, once the original American Kazoo Company, is the direct descendant of the shop opened by McIntyre and Richardson, founded in 1916. And the answer to our second question: which decade was the commonly accepted, quote-unquote, golden age of kazoos? Was that A, 1880s, B, 1920s, C, 1950s, or D, the 1970s? Correct answer, 1920s. Answer B. Many jazz groups used the kazoo in the 20s to imitate trumpets and trombones. These include the Mound City Blue Blowers, which had a banjoist, two kazooists, each on a different type of kazoo, and occasionally a guitarist or other musician. By the way, the illustrious kazoo has even made it into film. Carol Burnett, who played Miss Hannigan, played a kazoo in the movie version of Annie. So let's close out today's program with a bit of jazz music from the 1920s that includes a kazoo. This one is called Zigzag. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program, intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson, at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.